Decree of 1824 clearly states that a knowledge of the requisites of religion is incumbent upon all Muslims and must take precedence over all worldly considerations. Wherefore, no parent shall henceforth prevent his child from attending a school where he shall learn the Quran and articles of faith. Yet, the Board of Useful Affairs, created by Mahmud's own reorganized government, issued a report in 1838 that stated, "All arts and trades are products of science. Religious knowledge serves salvation in the world to come, but science serves perfection of man in this world. Astronomy, for example, serves the progress of navigation and the development of commerce. The mathematical sciences lead to the orderly conduct of warfare. Innumerable new and useful inventions, like the use of steam, came into existence in this manner. Without science, the people cannot know the meaning of love for the state and fatherland. The Ottoman Commonwealth had schools and scholars, that is, scientists, but they disappeared. Later, military, naval, engineering, and medical schools were opened with great effort, but students entering these schools lacked even ordinary knowledge for the proper reading of Turkish books. This was because of the defectiveness of the primary schools. Since the infrastructure for these higher, secular professional schools was not forthcoming from the traditional primary schools, certain new secondary, Rushdie schools were opened under the Tanzimat reformers. Under Tanzimat leadership, the gulf between the traditional and the modern widened systematically and immeasurably in all fields, not least in education. The Tanzimat leaders, who did drink heavily and for the most part one-sidedly at the gushing fountains of Western, particularly French, thought, were basically secularized men who lacked even the courage to face up to the issue of reforming traditional education. It was much easier to juxtapose the modern and the traditional. This meant the new enlightenment for the few, but the same old rut for the large masses of the people. The gulf between the traditional and the modern, the otherworldly and eternal, and the this-worldly and transitory, came to be the gulf between the elite and the Turkish masses. And since the Tanzimatists were professional followers and appeasers of the Western powers and their protege Christian minorities within the Ottoman rule, their overly pro-Western stand provoked a severe reaction among the young Ottomans, particularly Zia Pasha and Namik Kemal, who regarded the Tanzimat movement as both anti-Islamic and anti-Turkish. These young Ottomans therefore stressed, besides modernization, Islamic and national elements in education. Zia Pasha wrote, "Is there not a difference of climate? Is the situation of East and West the same? Could Racine or Lamartine adorn a Qasida like Nefi? Could Sinai or Farazdak write plays like Molière?" Again, "Islam, they say, is a stumbling block to the progress of the state. This story was not known before, and now it is the fashion. Forgetting our religious loyalty in all our affairs, following Frankish ideas is now the fashion." The idea that modern, useful technology may be introduced into a society while the traditional integrity of that society can be still maintained is, of course, naive. But with many Muslims, it was and continues to be the standard response. Yet those who hold the opposite view, that technological modernization necessarily entails wholesale or nearly wholesale westernization, are no less naive. This was, however, the stance of the majority of Tanzimatists. But with the young Ottomans like Zia Pasha and Namik Kemal, a new note was struck that was different from both. Political, scientific, and correspondingly social modernization, along with technological, while the cultural integrity of the nation remains intact. In the latter half of the 19th century, five prominent Muslim modernists were to formulate and expound the positive attitude of Islam toward science and an unhampered investigation of nature: Sayyid Ahmad Khan and Sayyid Amir Ali of India, Jamal ad-Din al-Afghani, Namık Kemal of Turkey, and Sheikh Muhammad Abdu. Amir Ali was the youngest of these. Among the rest, it is difficult to say who was the earliest. Most probably Sayyid Ahmed Khan was, since he had done some work on the reformulation of theology even before the Indian Rebellion of 1857, at the insistence of some of his British friends, although his undiluted modernism begins in the 1860s, after his brief stay in England. Al-Afghani might be considered next, except that his visit to Europe occurred at least a decade and a half after Sayyid Ahmad Khan's. Before this, his major modernist statement on the cultivation of science was his address delivered in Istanbul in December 1870, on the occasion of the opening of the Dar al-Funun, which, though aroused by contemporary needs, had as its source of inspiration the medieval Muslim scientist and philosopher Ibn Sina, died 1037. Since the views of Ibn Sina on the relationship between religion and philosophy had been severely castigated by the Islamic orthodoxy as extremely heretical, Al-Afghani's above-mentioned address caused such a furor that he had to leave Turkey. Namık Kemal, who had stayed and studied in Europe from 1867 to 1871, comes next. And finally comes Sheikh Muhammad Abdu, who was in Europe with Al-Afghani. All these men, who were contemporaries, enthusiastically preached the cultivation of science and appropriation of the scientific spirit of the West, although among them only Namık Kemal had actually been a student of law and economics in the West. Considering that, except for Al-Afghani and Abdu, these men hardly met each other, their arguments are amazingly similar. The integral constituents of their reasoning are, 1. That the flowering of science and the scientific spirit from the 9th to the 13th century among Muslims resulted from the fulfillment of the insistent Quranic requirement that man study the universe, the handiwork of God, which has been created for his benefit. 2. That in the later medieval centuries, the spirit of inquiry had severely declined in the Muslim world, and hence, Muslim society had stagnated and deteriorated. 3. That the West had cultivated scientific studies that it had borrowed largely from Muslims, and hence had prospered, even colonizing the Muslim countries themselves. And 4. That therefore Muslims, in learning science afresh from the developed West, would be both recovering their past and re-fulfilling the neglected commandments of the Quran. At this stage, the earlier argument for useful technology is replaced by a demand to cultivate science as such. Technology is certainly useful, but what is of primary importance is the cultivation of the spirit of scientific inquiry as demanded by the Quran. If we look at the three major exponents of this doctrine, Ahmad Khan, Namık Kemal, and Muhammad Abdu, we see that, beyond their basic agreement on the argument outlined above, they reveal substantial differences in attitude, especially as concerns the implications of modern science for the traditional Weltanschauung and for the realm of faith. In view of the fact that modern science asserts the eternity and immutability of natural law, does this science leave any room for a God who is the creator and sustainer of the universe, and who will destroy it at the approach of the day of resurrection? What can revelation mean for modern science? Will faith radically adjust itself to these new conceptions, or must there be mutual adjustment and interaction, or must the realms of faith and science keep separate? For Muhammad Abdu, although the medieval Muslim cosmology and worldview can be challenged by science, faith as such cannot. For faith, by its very nature, cannot be touched by science. The two have separate orbits, and each must keep within its own. Namık Kemal would not admit the claims of modern science beyond what is empirically proved. Since no one can ever prove the immutability of natural laws, there is not the slightest reason to believe in their eternity. God has made these laws and can unmake them as well. In this sense, Kemal is perhaps the most orthodox Muslim of the three, since, unlike Abdu, he subordinates the claims of science to the requirements of faith. While Abdu attempts to reintroduce a Mu'tazilite type of rationalism into Orthodox Islam and can even defend the medieval Muslim philosopher's rejection of physical resurrection, Kamal, although proud of the Muslim philosopher's achievements in the fields of science and philosophy, will not allow rationalism to destroy faith and has nothing but scorn for the Mu'tazila, who, despite their rationalist claims, were intolerant and illiberal. Sayyid Ahmad Khan is easily the most radical spirit of the three reformers. For him, there is no doubt that the modern scientific spirit or the laws of nature must set the criteria for judging the acceptability of a certain faith. So judged, Islam turns out to be, among the religions of the world, most in conformity with the laws of nature, and of all religious documents, the Quran is the most rational. Since Muslims have grossly misunderstood and misinterpreted the Quranic worldview in the past, and since the Orthodox Muslim theology is no longer valid, a fresh theology must be created from the Quran in the light of modern experience. In attempting this, Sayyid Ahmad Khan utilizes the arguments not only of the Mu'tazila, but, indeed patently, those of the Muslim philosophers. No wonder he turns out, in the end, to be almost a naturalist deist. Because his views were radical, he was not able to implement them in the Aligarh Muslim College created by him for the express purpose of integrating religious beliefs with a modern scientific outlook. In the end, as we shall see in the next section, religious education at Aligarh had to be left to traditionalist teachers who had no modern education whatever. While at the higher educational level, the modernists thus eased the adoption of modern science for the younger generation, there appeared a new type of work that brought home the practical moral content of Islam in the form of attractive stories. This was a major development, since before this, the only teaching of moral duties was through religious books that emphasized the consequences of wrongdoing, not in terms of harm done to society or to the wrongdoer as part of the society, but in terms of heaven and hell. Not only did the new literature make the moral impact of conduct more intelligible to the young reader, thus making moral teaching more effective, but its anecdotal form made reading more pleasant. This was in line with the attitude of the pre-modernist reformers of the 18th and 19th centuries, who had conceived of superstitions and antisocial practices in terms of social and moral degeneration in this world rather than in terms of otherworldly consequences. Muslims already had a secular ethical literature like the Akhlaq-i-Nasiri and Akhlaq-i-Jalali, books that had already been studied as part of the general Islamic literature, if not of the madrasa curriculum, but this was of a philosophical character. The new literature was produced for children. Closely allied with this trend, and to an extent genetically related to it, is the revival of interest in the past, both Islamic and local, national, historical and valuational. If the interest in modern scientism oriented the Muslims to the contemporary West, a study of their own history and value system reoriented them both toward Islam and toward their local, national traditions. It has been remarked by several students of modern Islam, including myself, that in the rediscovery of their tradition by modern Muslims, Islamic and national elements go together. This has often been characterized as a contradiction. As the two sides developed, they undoubtedly created a tension between nationalism and pan-Islamism. But while uncompromising nationalists like Mustafa Kemal and Mustafa Kemal were necessarily secular, it seems that in their genesis the two are closely allied or, in fact, even identified, and that the feeling for local nationalism was encouraged by identity with the Islamic past. Thus, Namiq Kemal could write both dramas, Salah ad-Din Ayyubi and Vatan, The Fatherland, with the same feeling and motivation. In the historical vision of Amir Ali, Shibli, and Iqbal, The Islamic history of Spain is indistinguishable from the Islamic history of India. Even a secular social and socialist reformer, the Central Asian Ismail Gasprinsky, could envision a regenerated and scientifically developed Muslim society that, in his dramatic work, he placed in Spain. To the secular Western scholars of Islam like W. Cantwell Smith, this is modern Muslim romanticism, just as to the Muslim modernist, modern Western secular nationalism is idolatry. It is this psychological intellectual development that resulted in demands for a system of education that would be modern but at the same time imbued with national Islamic values, whether national is seen as part of the Islamic goal or Islamic is viewed as part of the national. The concept of a culture-oriented education was developed in its most accentuated form by the Turkish sociologist Ziya Gökalp, who believed that, whereas science and the civilization founded upon it were universal and could be appropriated by any nation, culture and value commitments were unique growths peculiar to every society, and its national ethos and religion was part of culture. The goal of education was to inculcate these value commitments through tarbiyah, moral training, and communicate scientific knowledge through ta'lim, education. This sharp distinction between national cultural values and scientific or universal knowledge is finally untenable. Nevertheless, the assumption on which it rests, that modern science is cultivable in a variety of cultural settings, not only is not invalid, but is correct, as subsequent experience has shown. Gökalp was, however, attacked by one-track westernizers like Ismail Haki Baltajoglu, who patently misunderstood the meaning of Gökalp's stand as pure traditionalism harmful to the cultivation of modernity. Baltajoglu, in fact, advocated that cultural values be suppressed by the educational system, not encouraged by it. It is clear that Baltajoglu understood the cultural values of Gökalp to be what was actually being imparted by parents to children, that is, the moral status quo of the society. In a similar vein, Taha Hussein, in his Mustaqbal al-Thaqafa fi Misr, The Future of Culture in Egypt, attempted to prove that Egypt was essentially a Western land in terms of cultural orientation. Earlier, Syed Ahmad Khan had strongly advocated, through his Urdu journal Tadib-i-Akhlaq, the adoption by Indian Muslims of the entire lifestyle of Victorian England. Two factors, however, already hinted at above, determined Muslim countries not to identify themselves totally with the West through adopting entirely Western curricula: national aspirations of varying degrees of intensity and Islamic values. The first country to feel the impact of national aspirations was, again, Turkey. Gökalp had already elaborated a nationalist cultural ideology of education. The main change that occurred at the hands of Mustafa Kemal and his colleagues was that religion, Islam, was ousted from the public school curriculum. But even though a great plunge was taken to acquire Western learning, apparently at the expense of Islam, Turkish nationalism, of which the firebrand Ataturk was an embodiment, had already incorporated Islam as its integral constituent, and despite Ataturk's personal allergy to religion, Islam returned to national education, via nationalism, as inevitably as day follows night. Thus, despite the potential conflict of nationalism with Islam, there is an important sense in which they are inseparable. Witness the closing of the two Christian missionary schools in Bursa and Izmir by Ataturk's government, following the conversion to Christianity of two Muslim girls. In Muslim countries other than Turkey that were under direct or indirect Western colonial rule, Islam reasserted itself with a vengeance. First, as I indicated earlier, their peoples felt a much greater need to buttress their own identity away from the multiple colonial invasion, political, economic, intellectual, and moral, and hence proportionately emphasized their Islamicity. In several cases, notably in Indonesia, they set up their own educational institutions as distinguished from the public colonial government-sponsored schools. Alternatively, they sent their children, sons for the most part, to the public secular schools in the morning and to Islamic instruction centers in the afternoon or evening. Second, in all liberation movements directed against the colonial powers, the Islamic concept of jihad was heavily relied upon to arouse the sentiments of the general public against foreign rulers. So too was the Quranic verse, Surah 4, Ayah 59, "Obey God, the Messenger," that is, Muhammad, "and those put in authority over you from among yourselves," which implies that Muslims must not obey non-Muslim rulers. In other words, those concepts of Islam that make for a strong and cohesive Muslim community came to the fore. But in the meantime, other developments, quite apart from nationalism, took place that demanded a much weightier and more basic share for Islam in the newly emerging educational systems. Among those nations that were contiguous with or very close to Europe, particularly Turkey, there was already present in the latter half of the 19th century a realization that something was direly morally wrong with the West. Colonialism and economic imperialism were obvious evils, that is, exploitation of the resources of politically and industrially weaker nations to enrich homelands, of which Rome had been the first, though limited, example, but of which Western Europe became the full-scale embodiment, particularly in the 19th century. These nations were mortal enemies of each other, and they were brutal exploiters of dominated nations, although each of them was at home a democracy with an increasingly liberal, tolerant, and humanitarian outlook. Those Muslims who visited these Western countries were struck by this double, or rather multiple, standard of these beacons of civilization. But since international politics adhered to the law of the jungle, they had no choice but to play by the rules. In fact, many of them borrowed this type of nationalism for their own countries as well. Sayyid Ahmad Khan, as I hinted earlier, had developed a reformist ideology of Islam at whose center was the creation of a new science of theology that would not only be compatible with the Weltanschauung born of the new 19th century scientism, as Muhammad Abdu held, but would grow out of this Weltanschauung and the Quranic teaching at the same time. He was convinced that the latter absolutely backed the former. As I indicated before, his dream did not come true, at least not in his lifetime, for while he imported most of Aligarh's modern science teachers from Europe, particularly England, community pressure forced him to leave the teaching of religion to gentlemen brought from Deoband. The first generation produced from Aligarh naturally scoffed at the teachers of the Deobandi Islam, whom they regarded as survivals from the medieval past. Since, however, these early specimens of the Aligarh crop were not very well grounded in Western sciences, for it needed time to produce scholars who could even understand well the spirit of the new intellectual culture, let alone compete with their Western intellectual fathers in their own fields, they naturally invited the ridicule of the representatives of the older and more mature Islamic culture. So disquieted was Muhammad Shibli Nu'mani, the Indian historian of Islam and of Persian literature, with what he regarded as the extreme Westernism of the early crop of Aligarh, that he developed a new educational ideology that, to acquaint Muslim youth with Islamic culture, placed a greater emphasis on secular Arabic literature. He pioneered a new educational institution called the Nadwat al-Ulama, the Assembly of the Ulama, at Lucknow, of which I shall speak in the next section. A particularly prominent feature of the Nadwa education was the study of history, not so much to inculcate a truly historical spirit as to develop self-confidence and pride in the achievements of the Muslim past. Iqbal wrote no philosophy of education, let alone a program for the education of Muslims. Yet what he expressed by way of impatience with the existing forms of education, the orthodox, the Sufi, and the modern, was extremely powerful. Positive Sufism, the inculcation of a dynamic personality in service of truth, he appreciated deeply, but that was gone, and a negative Sufism, an escape from the problems of the world, was all that remained. In its growing influence upon the ulama, it had also destroyed the dynamism of the Orthodox. Further, the Orthodox had little left with them beyond meaningless philological discussions and hair-splitting details of questions more or less irrelevant to life. Of course, Iqbal was looking for an educational system that would render the human personality not just informed, but creative and dynamic. Of the Orthodox Alim and the Sufi Adept, he wrote, "I have a complaint, O God, against the schoolmen. They are training the children of falcons to roll in dust." Again, "You have been throttled at the outset by schoolmen, whence shall come the cry, 'There is no God but Allah.'" Iqbal was a particularly severe critic of modern knowledge, which seemed to him almost wholly weighted toward technology and materialism, and destructive of higher human values. In his poem, Pir i Rumi wa Muridi Hindi, where he questions Rumi on important issues and selects appropriate answers from Rumi's Mathnavi, the opening verse is, "The seeing eye sheds tears of blood. Modern knowledge has become destructive of religion." To which Rumi answers, "If you apply knowledge only to your body, it is like a poisonous snake. If you apply it to your heart, it becomes your friend." But in the same poem, Iqbal complains also of the depersonalizing effects that British education was having on Indian Muslims in particular. "Alas, the young and hot-blooded schoolboy is falling a helpless victim to the Western sorcerer." To which Rumi replies, "A bird caged for long, when it tries to fly, becomes an easy victim for every rending cat." This verse is a critique of both the traditional and the modern educational systems, the one incarcerating the mind and spirit in a cage, the second not merely giving a materialistic education that was out of tune with higher human values and particularly with the spiritual culture of Islam, but indoctrinating Muslim youth with the superiority of Western culture. It was the creation of men that, for Iqbal, was the goal of education. Traditional Muslim education had, with rare exceptions, failed in this for centuries. Perhaps its greatest trouble was that it had created the same dualism between the religious and the secular, between this worldly and that worldly, from which Christianity, for example, had suffered from its very beginnings. The religious scholar had become a professional in his own field, but he was ignorant of and unable to cope with the problems of the world he lived in. Now, the test of true spirituality or religious life is that it should solve these problems creatively. Otherwise, its claims to being spiritual or religious are untenable. And so Iqbal asks Rumi, "My lofty thoughts reach up to the heavens, but on earth I am humiliated, frustrated, and agonized. I am unable to manage the affairs of this world, and I constantly face stumbling blocks in this path. Why are the affairs of the world beyond my control? Why is the learned in religion a fool in the affairs of the world?" And he gets the following shattering answer. "Anyone who claims to be able to walk on the heavens, why should it be difficult for him to stalk on the earth?" Positively, Iqbal hardly gave anything that can be called a formulation of Muslim educational policies. Not only in education, but also in other fields of human endeavor, Iqbal left no positive legacy, except that he wanted an autonomous homeland for the Muslims, what is now Pakistan, so that they might be able to organize and direct their lives according to the precepts of Islam. Perhaps it was not his task to formulate policies. His performance consisted in arousing the Muslim and stirring him to the core, so that he could find for himself, amid the bewildering maze of modern theories, doctrines, and practices, a definite direction with specific policies to realize Islam on earth. What happened subsequently, we shall study in the following chapter. Here, we must now turn to delineating the major practical developments that occurred in this field before the middle of the 20th century. Practical modernist reforms. School education. We saw in the previous section that it was easier for the Ottomans to set up professional academies of higher learning, medical, engineering, and such, than to reform primary and secondary education, particularly the former, which was kept under the control of the madrasa system right up until the beginning of the present century. In my general remarks in the preceding section, I also observed that a country like Turkey, which preserved itself from falling under foreign rule, direct or indirect, faced much greater difficulty and took longer in modernization than did Egypt or the subcontinent of India when the latter came under direct British rule. This can be seen from the fact that Muhammad Ali of Egypt was able to establish a modern government school system earlier than the Ottomans. However, the Egyptian schools recruited pupils mostly from alien and non-Muslim nationalities, which, despite some foreign-modeled secular institutions in Turkey, would have been impossible in that country. When the Egyptian Muslims did go to Muhammad Ali's schools, they were more or less conscripted, and as a result, came mostly from the lower classes. In Turkey, since the ulama were so resistant to change, bridges were created in the middle and the later years of the 19th century between the primary and higher education in the form of rushdiye, or intermediate schools, which also, of course, had religious content in their curriculum. But while the problem in Turkey throughout the 19th century was how to introduce secular education at all, or how to weaken the hold of the clerics on education, the problem in Egypt in the latter half of that century, when Egyptian Muslims began to attend the general educational systems, was exactly the opposite, namely, how to make this school system, which had been both foreign-tailored and foreign-manned, more attuned to the religious, cultural, and national needs of Egypt. For Muhammad Ali's primary reason for establishing these schools had been to produce personnel for government and administration, not to produce a person imbued with Islamo-Egyptian culture. And those graduates who could not secure such employment, and they were the majority, were ill-equipped to earn a livelihood, a case strikingly similar to the products of the British system of education in India. Thus, Muhammad Abdu wrote, criticizing the government systems of school education, "This education is imparted so that the student may have in his hand a degree which would make it possible for him to occupy a clerical chair in a department, but that his personality should be shaped by education and by the inculcation of values, so that he becomes a good and proper man in himself, so that he should well execute the task entrusted to him in the government or outside it. This fact enters the minds neither of the teachers nor of those who appoint those teachers." And we are told the following about the primary government schools. "The students of these schools until now continue to be those children whose guardians' aim in educating them is to attain government service, whether they realize their goal or not. In the latter case, the child returns to his father or his guardian after finishing his books, having learned the elements of sciences for which he cannot find any application. He then degenerates into a moral state worse than those illiterate persons who nevertheless had remained in their natural condition, and, frustrated, he finds that he is unable to do the work that his father and family were engaged in. Thus he spends out his life either in total unemployment or nearly so." The poet Halli, although he had been instrumental in the propagation of Syed Ahmad Khan's policy of encouraging Indian Muslims to adopt modern British education, nevertheless, in his poem Musaddas, criticizes the product of that policy in much the same forms that Muhammad Abdu applied to the Egyptian educational system. "They neither can make their mark in government service, nor can they utter a word in the high durbar, nor yet can they haul goods on their backs in the bazaar, and no longer are they able to till fields either. Were they not educated, they could have earned livelihood in 100 ways, but they are completely lost, thanks to their education." In Turkey, modern primary education, as I mentioned earlier, was not introduced until about 1908. By the 1913 Primary Education Ordinance, primary education was divided into three classes: elementary, primary, and vocational technical. But the implementation of the law suffered from lack of adequate teachers in the technical field. Nevertheless, the law was a major step in departing from the traditional, purely religious primary education toward a practical concept of education. Religion, of course, continued to be taught until it was eliminated from the public school system under the Republic. Between 1913 and 1919, girls' education was also organized on a practical basis, the major subject being home economics. Another major step toward the nationalization of primary education was taken by the 1913 law in its requirement that all education be in the Turkish language, whereas, according to a law of 1879, each religious community, millet, could use its own language as the medium of instruction. Indeed, the period from the early 1900s through the Second Constitutional Period was a period of general intellectual and spiritual restlessness and awakening in Turkey and all aspects of life. The family institution, economy, politics, and education came under discussion. It was a period of free speech. In the field of primary education, certain non-madrasa public orators for the first time gave their message to the masses in such an uninhibited fashion that Niyazi Berkus has characterized them as effective eccentrics. The central theme of their preaching was exhortation to move the body, stand erect, run, wrestle. All these were violent affronts to the traditional conception of calm dignity. The open ridicule of certain settled habits and the glorification of the arts. So strong was this movement that even madrasas are said to have adopted gymnastics. Riza Tevfik, 1868-1949, Selim Sirri, 1874-1957, and Ismail Haki Baltajoglu, born 1889, whom I mentioned in the previous section in connection with the advocacy of a purely secular school education, typify this type of orator. The noted humanist deist Tevfik Fikret, 1867-1915, announced, on assuming the directorship of the Lycée of Galatasaray, his policy of religious educational reform by purging religion of superstitious beliefs, basing it instead on reason and science, and thereby healing the divorce between the world and religion created by the ulama. It should be noted that this was the call of most Muslim modernists as distinguished from the secularists, and it should be further borne in mind that Fikret's naturalism hardly differed from Sayyid Ahmad Khan's in India. Yet the opposition of the Turkish Islamists to Fikret was far less than that of the Indian Muslim conservatives had been to the ideas of Sayyid Ahmad Khan. Indeed, by that time, many, if not all, of the Turkish ulama had come to accept the idea that the Turkish youth should get an education that would imbue his character with both nationalist and scientific spirit. It was against this background of the debate between the Islamist, the Westernist, the liberal individualist, and those who stood for technical education that, as I indicated in the previous section, Ziya Gökalp appeared as the champion of a nationalist point of view that included the administration of Islamic values as expressed through Turkish mores to the Turkish youth, what he called tarbiya, upbringing or personality molding, in addition to and as distinct from education, which was supposed to be objective and purely scientific. However, by the law of 3 March 1924, called the Law of Unification of Education, all religious schools and madrasas, run either by the Ministry of Awqaf, pious endowments, or even by private Awqaf, were closed. Whereas the Tanzimat reformers had created a dualism between religious and secular instruction, and proposals were subsequently made, particularly by the Sadrazam, Chief Minister, Said Pasha, to reform the madrasas and to convert them into the theological faculties of his proposed universities, Ataturk's government, under the claim of unifying all education, eliminated the traditional schools, and thus all education became this-worldly or secular. That is, unification was achieved not by integration or synthesis, but by simply eliminating one of the two terms. The training of religious functionaries, imams and khatibs, was continued under the aegis of the Ministry of Education, but this was eliminated in 1928 when all religious education was dropped from the public school system. Not until the late 40s and early 50s was Islamic education resumed when, under sheer public pressure, a new system of Imam Khatib schools was started that, as we shall see in the next chapter, has expanded greatly up to the present. Thus we see that Turkey and Egypt, as far as religious school education is concerned, moved in opposite directions during the first half of this century. In Egypt, under the criticism of Muhammad Abdu and others, a public school system that had been purely secular in its genesis under Muhammad Ali incorporated courses in Islam in order to become more Islamic and national. In Turkey, on the other hand, a purely traditional school system gave way in the 20s to a system that was absolutely secular by design and with a vengeance. Since the developments in Egypt occurred naturally rather than by suppression, the integration of religious and secular education ran more smoothly. In Turkey, religious education was expunged from the curriculum of the public schools for about a quarter of a century. Most modernized Turks whom we meet today outside Turkey, particularly in the West, although, of course, many of them have received some Islamic education either at home or in private schools, are products of this purely secular system, whose two chief architects, Kemal Ataturk and İsmet İnönü, considered it a violation of the sanctity of the secularist principle even to mention the word Allah in public. Let us now turn to a brief consideration of higher Islamic education during the first half of the present century. Higher education. I indicated in Chapter 1 that in the 17th and 18th centuries, particularly in the latter, secular learning, mathematics, chemistry, astronomy, medicine, philosophy, and so on, existed both in Turkey and in Egypt, and it appears that the increasing resistance of the ulama to change was most probably linked with the pressures felt by the Muslim world from the colonial or quasi-colonial experiences. The more the threat of the Western powers and their advisors resulted in the creation of centers of purely secular learning, the more the ulama assumed a defensive posture and took refuge in their inheritance from the later Middle Ages and its sterile commentatorial literature. Nevertheless, unlike the situation in Turkey, there arose in Egypt a series of men who took up the work of the reform of Al-Azhar. Already during the first half of the 19th century, an Azhari sheikh, Rifa'a al-Tahtawi, who had lived for a number of years in Paris, opened a college of languages and translated the French constitution and French civil law into Arabic. He also was probably the first to contend, in his work Manahij al-Albab, that Muslims must learn all the modern sciences, since Europeans had developed them after borrowing them from Muslims themselves. He was highly critical of Muhammad Ali for not including these sciences in the current Azhar curriculum, although in the past they had been taught there. But the painful process of reform can perhaps be best illustrated in the words of the greatest of Azhar reformers, Sheikh Muhammad Abdu. After attending Sayyid Jamal ad-Din al-Afghani's lectures, I turned my attention to the problem of the reform of Al-Azhar, since I was a student there. When I actually began work, I was prevented from it. Then, after my return from exile, I tried to convince Sheikh Muhammad al-Anbabi, then Sheikh al-Azhar, to accept certain proposals, but he refused. Once I said to him, "Would you agree, O Sheikh, to order that the Muqaddima of Ibn Khaldun be taught at al-Azhar?" And I described to him whatever I could of the benefits of this work. He replied, "It would be against the tradition of teaching at al-Azhar." During our intricate conversation, I began talking to him about some more recent sheikhs, that is, professors of Al-Azhar, and asked him, "How long ago did Al-Ashmuni and As-Saban die?" He replied that they had died only so many years ago. I then said, "They have died only recently, and yet their books are being taught, and there had been no tradition of teaching them." Sheikh Al-Anbabi was silent and did not reply. Al-Azhar went through a series of organizational and administrative reforms from 1872 to 1930, beginning with the requirement of a final examination resulting in a degree, called Al-Alimiyya, determining the hierarchy, salaries, and scales of its teachers, and finally creating three fields of instruction: theology, Islamic law, and Arabic language and literature, 1930. But my purpose in this work is to study intellectual developments rather than administrative reforms. However, critiques such as those of Muhammad Abdu and of Muhammad ibn Ibrahim al-Zawahiri in his Kitab al-Ilm wal-Ulama, the Book of Scholarship and Scholars, issued from Tanta in 1905, show that even the law of 1872 was very imperfectly implemented. Of these two critiques, that of Muhammad Abdu is obviously more radical. He thinks of reform in terms of a primarily intellectual and positive renaissance of Islam, while al-Zawahiri's conception of the reform of al-Azhar is more in pietistic terms. Both agree, however, that the law governing the examination is poorly applied, that students loiter around without attending lectures, that most teachers are engaged in running each other down and showing themselves off rather than in teaching students, and that both students and teachers are content with minimal standards. Al-Zawahiri rightly points out that the ulama are not just professionals like the holders of the degrees in engineering or other professions, for upon their shoulders lies the task of the moral leadership of society. Therefore, for the holders of the Alimiyya degree to pride themselves on it and to stop building upon it by further acquisition of knowledge and improvement of character detracted from their standing as ulama and degraded them in the eyes of the public. During the last quarter of the 19th century and the early years of the 20th, the intellectual, spiritual milieu at Al-Azhar was, on the whole, very conservative. The khedival politics and intrigues, the palace was certainly not a friend of Muhammad Abdu's ideas, certainly played their part, but even without these, the pace of progress was slow, since most sheikhs, even if they fully understood the meaning of the reforms, were averse to them, and many thought they would undermine Islam. Abdu himself insisted on gradual reform only and was particularly anxious to keep Al-Azhar independent of government interference. We can guess something of Al-Azhar's milieu from a story told by Al-Zawahiri. A Lebanese Muslim, having heard of the great learning of Al-Anbabi, who was rector of Al-Azhar, journeyed to Egypt to see him. This must have been in the 1890s. And when the intermediary introduced the visitor to the sheikh as having traveled from Lebanon, the sheikh replied by asking, "Where is Lebanon?" Or rather, "Where is Mount Lebanon?" since the story dates from the time when Lebanon was part of Syria and was known as Mount Lebanon. The visitor then exclaimed, "By God, I have wasted every step I took to visit the sheikh." Abdu himself was disappointed in the reform of Al-Azhar and, in view of the rigidity of the Al-Azhar curriculum, began advising the government to set up a separate college for training lawyers, Dar al-Qada, independent of Al-Azhar. When, finally, Abdu was forced to resign from the Council of Al-Azhar in March 1905, Sheikh al-Sharbini, the rector of Al-Azhar, said, "The aim of our forefathers in setting up Al-Azhar was to establish a house of God, that is, a mosque wherein he would be worshipped. As for the worldly affairs and modern learning, they have nothing to do with Al-Azhar." That man, Abdu, wanted to destroy the clear paths of religious instruction and to convert this great mosque into a school of philosophy and literature. The Khedive Abbas II spoke in a similar vein on the occasion of Sharbini's installation as Sheikh al-Azhar. The distance between the two aforementioned critics of al-Azhar, Abdu and al-Zawahiri, can be seen from the fact that the latter's ideal as an alim would be a person who combines in himself the qualities of an Abdu and a Sharbini. There is little doubt or even wonder that, to many of his contemporary reformers and even progressives, Abdu must have seemed a pure secularist out to destroy Islam. Yet it would still take some imagination to fuse Abdu and Sharbini into a single personality. It was, indeed, Abdu who boldly expressed the view that Al-Azhar might be merged into the general educational system, as the center of Islamic education, instead of remaining a curious enclave or museum of Islamic medievalism, and further, that after the institutions of learning in the general education system are duly reformed, see the preceding section of this chapter, and genuine and effective Islamic instruction is introduced in them, the importance of Al-Azhar will, in any case, diminish, because people send their children to Al-Azhar instead of public schools, since they believe that Al-Azhar better preserves their faith for them. It needs to be pointed out with some emphasis that Abdu contended not only for the introduction of modern Western learning into Al-Azhar, but, what is not generally recognized or understood, for the revival of old and original Islamic classics. Witness his desire for the inclusion of Ibn Khaldun's Muqaddima into the curriculum, including the theological works of the rationalist Mu'tazila school, which had been boycotted for centuries as heretical. Indeed, to rediscover modernity in the original Islamic tradition itself was a cornerstone of Abdu's reformist thinking. When the 1872 law of Al-Azhar was promulgated under the sheikhhood of Muhammad al-Abbasi al-Mahdi, the following 11 areas were named as examination subjects: Islamic law, fiqh, Islamic jurisprudence, theology, hadith, Quran exegesis. Note the absence of the teaching of the Quran by itself, untied to commentaries, a characteristic of all medieval institutions of Islamic learning. Arabic syntax and morphology, and the three sciences of rhetoric, eloquence and literary style, and logic. With regard to logic, philosophy was, of course, banned. Although the controversy persisted concerning the advisability of teaching a subject that was intermixed with philosophy, it continued to be taught as an instrumental science because of the aid it afforded to correct thinking processes. In 1887, a government-inspired question was put to the Sheikh al-Azhar al-Anbabi whether it was permissible, indeed necessary, for Muslims to acquire such sciences as mathematics, astronomy, physics, and chemistry to increase the capacity of the Muslim community to compete with contemporary nations. In the question, an appeal was made to the authority of al-Ghazali, who had written that it was obligatory upon the community as a whole to ensure that a sufficient number of its members study these sciences, and to the fact that scholars of the Hanafi school had agreed with al-Ghazali's view. The questioner also took care to add that the position of these natural sciences would be that of instrumental sciences like logic, which are studied not for their own sake, but for the benefits that accrue from them. Compare the useful knowledge concept in Turkey discussed earlier in this chapter. Al-Anbabi, who knew the real source of this question, affirmed in his answer that it was necessary for Muslims to study these sciences, warning, however, that astronomy should not be studied for astrological purposes and that physics should be studied in conformity with the Sharia and not in the way of the medieval Muslim philosophers, since that would be unlawful. By the way of the philosophers, of course, the Sheikh meant such doctrines as the eternity of the world and, implicitly, the eternity of the laws of nature, which might undermine the belief in the hereafter. Sheikh al-Anbabi had, of course, no intention of carrying out this reform, since, as we have seen, he was even opposed to the study of Ibn Khaldun's Muqaddimah, which Abdu proposed later than this fatwa. Abdu returned from exile in 1888. The implementation came in 1896, but the new sciences were made optional for the final examination. When, in 1907, as Abdu had proposed, a separate college was established for training experts in Islamic law to function in religious courts, the Azharis really saw the danger signal and realized the necessity of reform. The law of 1908 made obligatory the examination in the modern sciences, history, geography, mathematics, physics, and chemistry, as well as in the religious sciences. However, when the 1911 law raised the period of instruction from 12 to 15 years and divided it into three levels, primary, secondary, and advanced, the teaching of these modern sciences was restricted to the first two levels, leaving the advanced level entirely for religious sciences. Philosophy, so much dreaded by the ulama, was not brought into the curriculum until 1930, and later both ancient and modern philosophy, including psychology and sociology, began to be taught. But again, these new branches of knowledge were taught only in the lower levels, so that their instruction, except in rare and individual cases, remained very superficial. For a wholesale modernization of Al-Azhar, we have to await the 1960s and 1970s. Despite its limitations, however, the progress of Al-Azhar by the law of 1936, which supplemented the 1930 measures, had come a long way from 1872. The development of the ability of religious thought to cope with the modern challenges is a problem that has baffled experts and will continue to do so, but it seems to me that for a life-oriented and socially geared religion like Islam, it is more necessary to teach philosophy and social sciences than the individual physical sciences, except at the elementary level, at the highest possible level. But there are other practical demands to be met, and I shall discuss this particular question more fully in the next chapter. For the time being, I shall turn to developments in the eastern lands of Islam, after a few remarks about Turkey. In the preceding section, I have discussed lower education in Turkey, culminating in the Kemalist closure not only of religious schools, but of all religious teaching in the public school system. There is not much more to be said of the higher Islamic education except that, during the reign of Abdulhamid II, the Prime Minister, Sadrazam, Sayyid Pasha, drew up a grand proposal for setting up in every provincial capital of the Ottoman Empire a university and an institution of higher technological learning, the one fed by the Sultaniye schools and the other by the Rushdiye schools, with all higher institutions of religious learning, Islamic, Christian, etc., becoming theological faculties in the universities for each respective religious community. This grand scheme did not materialize, and after the abortive closing of the Dar al-Funun mentioned earlier in this chapter, madrasas and secular educational institutions operated side by side. In 1909, about 15 years after the formal, though as yet nominal, introduction of modern sciences into Al-Azhar, the original madrasa of Muhammad Mehmet the Conqueror was revived with the hope from both sides, the Westernists and the Islamists, of putting through a synthesized and reformed curriculum. This institution was to have four faculties: religious sciences, which besides traditional subjects included ethics; hikmat sciences, comprising philosophy, mathematics, and all the natural sciences; the science of history, including the prophet's biography; and languages, Arabic, Turkish, and Persian. When the Sheikh al-Islam attempted, on this pretext, to extend his authority of censorship beyond his powers, this led, in 1916, to the removal of religious education, among other things, from his control. Religious education was thus given over to the Ministry of Education. The most striking feature throughout the educational developments in Turkey has been the identification of the religious with the eternal and unchangeable, and the secular with the changeable. This has been the real bane of Turkish Islam, a continuous expansion of the secular and a concomitant relegation of the religious to the background. It is this confusion that also haunted the thinking of Gökalp, who drafted the proposal for the 1916 law. Ottoman Turkey lacked a central madrasa like Al-Azhar and, what is far more important, a modernist alim like Abdu. The law of 1916 was destined to be the first step toward that unification of education that Mustafa Kemal completed by abolishing religious education. The unchangeable vanished before the changeable. It remained for Mustafa Sabri, the last Sheikh al-Islam, who emigrated to Egypt, to write a multi-volume work in defense of Ash'ari predestinarianism, while much earlier Abdu had resurrected, despite fierce opposition, human free will and a rationalistic approach to religion in Egypt. Two important general points deserve notice concerning modern developments. The first related to all historical lands of Islam, that is, the Middle East, North Africa, Turkey, Iran, and the subcontinent, or rather more precisely in terms of Arabic, Turkish, Persian, and Urdu languages. In all these languages, the medieval style was artificial, ornate, and difficult to understand, and the content was unoriginal, characterized by obscurity of expression rather than expression of obscurity. Apart from artificial trends in pure literature, in both poetry and prose, the so-called language sciences mentioned in the first chapter, eloquence, rhetoric, and style, with the artificial and far-fetched devices, images, similes, and constructions produced by them, put a heavy and often distasteful emphasis on expression at the expense of meaning. The commentatorial character of the later writings in the field of non-literary or technical learning compounded the viciousness of these trends and added to them an often obnoxious, pedantic air. One common feature of the new literary reform that affected all teaching during the 19th and 20th centuries was the simplification of style into a direct and natural one. In the field of Islamic literature and education in particular, the names of Cevdet Pasha and Namık Kemal in Turkey, Abdu and his colleagues in Egypt, Sayyid Ahmad Khan, Halli, and others in the subcontinent stand out. The emergence of the popular press, of course, both reflected and affected this development. The new reformed style had a great impact on all branches of learning, particularly in ethics, history, geography, and such. This in itself is a major, indeed basic, revolution. In all these languages, poetry, the real magic of the Oriental mind, was effectively used for reform purposes, and the new, easily accessible style helped the whole cause of reform and education. In the subcontinent, it was Altaf Hussein Halli, a right-hand man of Ahmad Khan, who set the pioneering example followed by Muhammad Iqbal. The influence of Halli's died 1914, Musaddas, a moving poem on the fall of Islam consisting of stanzas of 6 lines each, with its realism and stark sincerity, its direct and pungent style, has been incalculable in Indian Islam in terms of arousing Muslims to their plight of insufferable decline and decay. While this poem is essentially a critique of literally all segments and strata of Indian Muslim society, it was Iqbal's grand style poetry that moved people to action. The second general point to be remembered is that the 1,000-year-old ulama tradition, despite its stagnation in the later centuries, had nevertheless a rich and highly sophisticated heritage. It could boast of 1,000 original personalities, highly synthetic and creative figures in the various fields of the vast Islamic civilization. Even the commentators, while they more or less effectively lost their grasp on the bases of the sciences, nevertheless were often expert in their fields, up to their minutiae. Now, Whenever a major change occurs in an educational system by the introduction of new subjects, the standards are bound to go down, simply because it takes time to attain expertise in the new fields. If the new subjects are organically related to the old ones, the backlash is not so big, and the hiatus not so long, since the whole develops and rises as a whole. In the Muslim world, however, the new education did not start out integrated with the old, since the representatives of old education did not want this, nor, in most cases, did the espousers of the new. For this reason, the two remained mostly segregated for a long time, and in many countries they still remain so. A further complicating factor was that this new education had been transplanted from another living organism in Europe, with its own cultural background and its own internal structure and consistency. Although this had happened earlier to Islam with the influx of Greek philosophy and science into the Islamic intellectual and spiritual stream, the main difference from the present situation was that the Greek civilization was dead, while the Islamic civilization was alive and powerful, and hence could face the challenge of the Greek sciences on its own.